Good morning. My name is Tim Walbrecht. For those that didn't meet me yesterday afternoon, I am from Redmond, Washington. And for about 12, 13 years, I worked in a parish as a youth director, which far outlasted the national average of youth directors, which on the national average is less than 2 years of parish ministry. That's the national average. People ask me, how did I survive? I told them about the first 11 years I was trying to figure out what to do, and then I burned out once I figured out what I needed to do, and then I lasted my year and a half, and that was about it. I'm also a counselor. I have worked with families and adolescents in the past number of years, and I have a wife and three children, and I have a son and daughter that are approaching the adolescent years quite rapidly. And part of my interest in adolescence not only comes from my work with them over the years, but also with, I'm trying to convince my children to skip those years, if at all possible. I have statements that I'm trying to get them to sign, and I have not been able to successful yet, so I don't know. Part of what I hope to do this morning is to affirm those of you who are parents. I need to know who amongst you here have children that are age 12 through 18 or 19. Okay, so you're in that. Okay. How many here have children that are fast approaching that age? Also some others. Okay, good. All right. How many of you here wish you were an adolescent? Oh, you're strange. I'll get your name down. And with the structure that happens now, I think in our culture, there's a lot where a lot more grandparents are involved in dealing with adolescents too. There's the grandparents just happen to be around a lot. So I'm glad.
How many of us survived our children's adolescence?
That's a good question. How many of you survived? Because I'm going to.
Wasn't sure I was going to.
That's what I like to hear. Okay. Anybody else survive their children going through the adolescent years? Because. Oh yeah. All right. See. All right. See. Nice. And live and breathing, and that's great.
Not too well.
Not too. What I want to do today is I want to share some of the good of it, and I want to share some of the concerns. I want us to keep in the back of our mind what we can be doing as a church, and what we can be doing as parents, and what we can be doing as Christians. Part of how I present this is on a lighthearted manner. I think when you work with adolescents, the length that I did, part of the reason I was able to survive was I was able to do it on a serious side, but there's also a lighthearted side. And I think as parenting and as parents of adolescents, I think we need to keep that balance in mind, that we need to incorporate some of the lightheartedness into this time. And it is, and it can, and it will be a fun time a lot of times. So that's basically my introduction. Let me read some of the good news, statistically. Good news. In 1983, there was a study by the National Association of Secondary Principals. They surveyed 1,200 adolescents aged 13 through 18. They had 986 responses, which is a high response, actually. The study results. Kids agreed with their parents on the following subjects. They agreed with their parents concerning drugs, 82%. On education, 81%. On work, 80%. On politics, 77%. On choice of friends, 75%. On religion, 74%. On sex, 70%. And on clothing, 65%. So the adolescents do tend to agree with the parents. They also found out that of those surveyed, there were strict rules in the family concerning curfew, 69%. Of the kids had a strict curfew. So when your adolescent comes in and says, everybody else get to stay out, or everybody else does not have a curfew, you say, no, 69% of all adolescents have strict curfew, and we will stay with that. Time, there were strict rules concerning time for chores to be done, was close to 50%. 50% on choice of friends, strict rules concerning choice of friends. Dating, 43%. Schoolwork, 42%. And career, 38%. At the same time, there's some sad news.
Who conducted that study?
This was done by the National Association of Secondary Principals. And it was nationwide. Okay. There's some sad news, some concerns. Pregnancy, there are 11 million, it's assumed that there are 11 million sexually active teens. There are over 1 million teenage pregnancies a year, resulting in 590,000 births, 276,000 abortions, and 125,000 miscarriages. Parental influence, another study. This is interesting. How many think that the kids really listen to the parents? I mean, really listen to them. Yeah. Studies are showing that. I couldn't find in my file, there was a study done 4 or 5 years ago where kids were asked to list the most influential people in their lives or groups in their lives, and parents ranked either as, you know, two parents, either first or second, and then the second or first, depending on male, female, and I can't remember, was their other siblings. Peers ended up being third or fourth on the list, which is interesting. But this one came out of Journal of Marriage and Family. It was a study that was conducted in 63, 76, and 82, and teenagers were asked who they sought out for advice on a number of issues and concerns ranging from career choices to sex. And among the findings were, for teenage boys, parental influence was the highest, 42%, in 1963. It was the lowest, 18%, in 1976, and it's climbing back up. It's up to 30% as of 1983. For teenage girls, parental influence was very high, 65% in 63, lower, 31% in 76, and lower still, 25% in 1983. For teenage boys, peer influence was low in 63, it was only 22%. It was high, 50% in 1976, but it has dropped down to 32% in 1983. For teenage girls, peer influence was low, 10% in 63, higher in 39% in 76, and dropping back down to 33% in 83. Combining boys and girls' figures, the researchers found that parents, while losing influence during the 70s, were gaining influence in the 80s, although with boys only. Peer influence rose very fast in the 70s, 44.5%, but appears to be on the decline in the 80s, 32.5%. One interesting finding was that for girls, both parent and peer influence declined in the 80s. Okay, that's for the girls. Both parent and peer influence declined in the 80s. This may be the result of more independent thinking on the part of today's young women. Interesting. Drugs. Anybody want to hear about some drugs? The trend today, and this is based on a November 1987 statistical printout. The trend today, unfortunately, is more and more drugs at a younger and younger age. Drug treatment centers are increasingly admitting younger adolescents to their programs, children of the age of 10 and 11. And it's across ethnic and cultural spectrums, okay? An alarming and problematic trend that has been building for the last 10 years is the mixing of drugs, known as the polydrug use. Does anybody know what that is, mixing drugs? That's when you, like, take cocaine and also drink alcohol at the same time. Okay. It is extremely dangerous due to the effects that often result when two or more drugs are combined. Marijuana is still popular, although its use fluctuates with its availability. The big danger today with marijuana is what?
It's laced with other drugs.
Yeah, it can be laced with other drugs.
It's much stronger than it was.
10 to 20% stronger than it was 10 years ago, or during the Vietnam era, 15 years ago. Popular among younger teens are what is called the look-alike drugs. These are manufactured to look like a particular drug, and they imitate the drug's effects. Junior high kids are often told that they are buying speed or cocaine when the actual drug is caffeine. Act-alike drugs are similar to the look-alike drugs in that they imitate the effects of a certain drug but do not physically look like the drug being imitated. Both act-alike drugs and look-alike drugs are dangerous because the user does not know what he or she is really taking. Also popular with the younger crowd is the sniffing of solvents. And the increasing sniffing of solvent, the number one, seems to be the number one, is not glue any longer. Does anybody know what it is? Typewriter correction fluid. Because it's easier, it's popular because it's inexpensive, it's easier to maintain, and it's produce, and it can produce a quick high. I am not tempted to go home and try that at the time. Alcohol has been very popular, of course. It is still the drug of choice. And wine coolers are fast becoming the standard amongst high school students. You see the increase of wine cooler television commercials on popular MTV and also on other shows. And it's interesting, I was told this once at a conference that the vast majority, not a vast majority, about 40-45% of the youth that are drinking wine coolers do not realize that there's alcohol in it. They think it's an alcohol substitute drink. Somewhere they got that message, and that's what they get. And even if it says on the label, they don't read the label, I guess. Efforts by such groups as SAD and MAD seem to be paying off, only in that the kids are being conscious of the fact that they are not to drink, not to drive after they drink. It hasn't cut down necessarily on the drinking, but at least they are staying away from the driving, made it more conscious. The big drug today is, of course, cocaine, also known as coke, blow, snow, vitamin C, crack, and rock. 10 years ago, there was about 10% of the nation's high school seniors had used cocaine. Today, that figure has doubled. Cocaine is now trendy, is seen as being trendy, glamorous, chic, fashionable. It's a drug associated with a fast life, and by rock stars and athletes and so forth. And the popular form of cocaine known as coke or crack or rock is a mixture of cocaine with baking soda and water. This creates a paste that can be as high as 70% cocaine. While the paste hardens, it is cut into pieces that look like white gravel, hence the name rock. And with crack, it is smoked. It is not inhaled. It is not sniffed. It is smoked. It produces a 20 to 30 minute high, which begins almost immediately as compared to the regular use of cocaine, which takes 5 minutes approximately to get the high. The euphoria or intense rush received from crack has been described by users with words such as power, better than sex, incredible energy, and orgasmic. Highly addictive and dangerous, crack is easy to make, easy to hide, and easy to use, and very cheap, costing only $5 to $15 for a high. That's some of the sad part that goes with it too. So what do we do with all that? Well, that's a very good question. What I want to attempt now is to just basically go through some of the development aspects of adolescence and of what they're going through and talk a little bit about that and get some feedback on how other people kind of see some things. Give some suggestions possibly on how to deal with or how to prepare some adolescents. There is one, I carried this around in my wallet. This one characteristic that I have found in both in literature and in dealing with teenagers is that they have a very, they don't have a sense of destruction of themselves, or a very poor sense of it. They do not feel that they're going to die. Okay. We had an accident in Redmond in which two kids, teenagers, were killed. They were at one party and they were drinking. They were going to look for another party and they smashed into a bridge and the driver survived and two of the other kids were killed. And they had this in on the editorial section of the Seattle Times, and it was a teenage epitaph, "A Friend Says It All." And it says, "After Ian Olson, 16, and David Dirk, 17, were killed in a high-speed automobile accident in Redmond last weekend, their friend, Ty Rios, 16, made the following comment. We all thought we were indestructible. We were the tough guys. We have wrecked plenty of cars before. We thought we could not get hurt. We thought we could not die." Okay. what happens to adolescents when they become adolescents? Well, let's talk a little bit about the mental, the emotional, the social, the physical, and the spiritual aspects. Okay? Very briefly, if you want more detail on these five subjects, I did a tape several years ago on these five subjects here at Holden. It goes in a little greater detail than we have time for today, but I'll just give you a brief overview of it. Okay. Mentally, of course, if they shift from concrete to abstract thinking, thanks to such work as Piaget and others. And concrete operations are those operations where you would ask the young person, how many days was Noah on the ark? That's a concrete operation, and they can give you the number. And more abstract thinking for this age, which makes it wonderful if you're teaching confirmation classes or if you're teaching any type of classes, would be to add such questions as, why would God do this to Noah? Or how could a God of love do this, you know, to the world? That's an abstract thought and gets the person thinking. So it's that shifting going on. Most of the teenagers have more than 50% of their total adult mental capabilities by the time they are in the adolescent years. Thereupon, they tend to bore very easily. Okay, they bore in classrooms. They bore in confirmation classes, and they just tend to bore quite easily. Emotionally, what's going on with them? Well, for those that have been around them, either as parents or have witnessed from afar what's going on, you will notice that they will try on many different personalities. For size, they are very unpredictable, and they like to use trial and error. In other words, one moment they will be happy and go lucky, and the next moment they will be totally depressed or down. They will come up and act one way to some people, and they'll run over to this person and act another way. They're trying on all of these different types of personalities that they have witnessed through their growing up to these years. They also like to use arguments. Teenagers need to argue. They need to argue for argument's sake. They need to know, and they need to know how, they need to develop ways of arguing. So, and to test that out, they have to argue. Well, the people that they're going to argue with are going to be the people within the family, and mostly it's going to be mom or dad. So if your adolescent tends to be arguing a lot, that's normal. Just take a deep breath, let them argue. Stay out of the conflict as much as you can, agree with them where you can, just shake your head, look them in the eye, and just let them argue, because I'm willing to bet within 5 or 6 minutes either they have forgot what they were arguing about, or they have changed their position, you know, about 180 degrees. They've come around to another position, but that happens. Teenagers cannot hide their emotions very well. They tend to have very intense emotions. My request of all parents, all people working with adolescents, is that you don't play on their emotions. When they are happy, they are really happy. And when they are sad, they are super sad. And sadness can be from anything from receiving a bad grade, to failure to making the team, to broken romances. Now, we have the experience, I believe, of going through some of that. They don't. We can, you know, we can easily go up to them and say, oh, you'll get over it, or, you know, I went through it too, and you're fine, and it's not, don't get so upset about it, and stuff like that. No, they don't have that concept. They don't see the light at the end of the tunnel. They don't see that down the line that they will also have these experiences, and this is all part of life. They need to be told that this is all part of life, but they also need to experience some of that, and they don't need us in there to rescue them from those feelings. We have to identify those feelings with them, but we don't have to rescue it from them. But don't play on their emotions. And part of that, I think, comes too, and it's a scary aspect, is that there's a 200% increase in suicide amongst adolescents. Okay, and in adolescents, if they get a bad grade, will get depressed. There was an instance, again, in the Seattle area about 4 or 5 years ago in one high school. They had, within about a week's time, they had 4 or 5 suicides. And the one person who kind of started off this pattern happened to be the student body president, three-year letterman, straight-A student, you know, had everything, had all the colleges were after him and all this sort of stuff. And he went up to Snoqualmie Falls and he jumped off. And a lot of the kids in his class had the feeling, you know, if this person, if all of life, all these pressures are getting to this person, then what about me? You know, I remember that the University of Washington sent over a team of people, and they spent weeks dealing with that high school. And it was a large high school. And I can't remember exactly what set it off for that young person, but it's kind of sad. One thing that you can do is assure them that their faith is not dependent on how they feel. In other words, you don't have to feel good to be loved by God. And they need to hear that. They need to hear it from you when you're not feeling all that good either. Assure them that your love is not dependent on how they feel. Have patience, don't panic. Try to be consistent. See, children tend to fret, but teenagers worry. And they will worry about themselves. They will worry about what they will look like. I always encourage parents to always tell the adolescent that they look nice, even when they aren't supposed to be told that. They need to be reassured, okay? We tend to tell them, like, if they're getting dressed up for a date, how nice they look, or if they're, you know, really, really nice. By the way, I'm getting ahead of myself. I'll come back to that. But we need to tell them at times when they maybe not even look that well, that they do look nice, okay? Teens also tend to worry about the future, and I have what they are fretting about. There was a study made 2 years ago, a national study, on what they were fretting about, and I can't seem to put my finger on it, but the number one item happened to be 76% of this survey, the kids were worried about being kidnapped. And this was about 2 years ago when we had a big push nationally about missing children, okay? So the kids were responding to that. Second, about 65%, if I remember, were worried about AIDS. Another 65% were worried about nuclear war. Other issues in there, and I don't have the numbers, were world hunger, death of a friend, death of a parent, things like that. But the number one was kidnapping. And so they kind of, they do worry about the future. Physically, it is the onset of puberty, of course. It is a changing from childhood to adulthood. It's massive growth. I had a good friend now. He's a young adult. He wasn't so good of a friend when he was in junior high and senior high, but especially in senior high, Rick Hinkle, if you listen to this, Rick, I'm talking about you again, who in May of 1 year was about a half an inch shorter than I am. Then he left to go be with his mother and stepfather in Colorado, and he was gone the whole summer, and he returned at the end of August, and he had grown 7.5 inches. I kid you not. I was looking up at him all in one summer. And that's the type of growth that goes on with these people. It's a new awareness of the body, the age-old ritual of the high school boys stealing the junior high girls. Teenage girls tend to worry about two things, height and breast development. Boys tend to worry about two things, height and feet. The size of their feet. The national average. This is a good one, folks. This is a good one. The junior high girls. Nationally, the junior high girls spend up to 7 hours a day priming themselves.
7 hours
a day. I didn't realize there were that many hours in the day when you put everything else in. And a good part about the physical is that the boys actually begin taking showers without being told. Right? And watch your water bill. Right up out the ceiling. There's also with this big.
Do they want big feet? I have to know about the feet.
Oh, do they want big feet?
Is that what they're?
No, no. Their feet get quite large.
Oh, and they don't want them to be.
They don't want them, especially when they start tripping over them. You will notice that as adolescents come around, the kids become awkward. They go through this phase. I recommend to parents that you put away your best china. Because it will get broken. They become all thumbs. Yep. They trip over their feet. They'll trip over anything. They'll trip over molecules. They'll trip over dust. And that's part of the big feet. And it's amazing because a lot of teenage boys' feet really grow quite large while the rest of them don't. They're almost, and they get very sensitive to that.
Although eventually I think the size of the feet correlates with your height.
Oh, yes.
The general thing. So you could maybe reassure them about it by saying, hey, if you got big feet, it'll mean you'll be a little taller, which is considered desirable.
Mm-hmm. Yes, very much so. And I would recommend anything, you know, you need to encourage as time goes on. Concerning that, I have, let me talk a little bit, this is on, I put it under physical, but it's three areas. One's called wasting time, the other is called solitude and privacy. Wasting time is also known as daydreaming. And you will notice that the adolescent tends, well, the posture is usually on the couch with one leg propped over the back end and one arm slung down off the side and the other leg, you know, somewhere there, and they seem to be, their eyes are you know, just kind of staring off into never. Another time that you will notice this is when if they're watching TV, they're not watching TV, their eyes are focused off the TV, just kind of off to nowhere type of bit. Okay, you can go out and turn off TV and they won't move, you know, something like that. But actually what it is, it's normal. Any doctor could tell you that too. The energized body needs to slow down, and what they do is they, quote, waste time. They sit or they lie down. It's the use of quiet time for fantasizing, for testing. Adolescents will test out what you've been telling them all their years growing up, or what you're telling them as an adolescent. They are testing that out. They're running scenarios through their head, you know, on what they've been learning. So this is quite normal. Actually, the more studies are showing that the more wasting time, what we call wasting time, daydreaming, can increase achievement and motivation. My advice to parents is to stop worrying. If it becomes a big concern for you, maybe you need to examine your own attitude about work and make sure the adolescent knows what you expect of them. Related to that is the issue of solitude. Solitude plays an important role in the adolescent life. If the adolescent is granted a certain amount of solitude, being alone, the young person you will find is more pleasant to be around when they re-enter the family system, so to speak. So give them space to be alone. It makes for more pleasurable time. And then concerning privacy, I feel that my position is that adolescents, as most people in the family, have the right to have a private life in addition to functioning within the family. The private life meaning they generate their own friends, they generate their own space, they generate their own time. They have the right privacy to be alone, they have a right to be different, to change and mature, and to leave home. I know one, you know, a big concern for parents when the adolescent is around is how they dress. And you talk to them, talk to a teenager, and they have this big thing about, I want to dress and be an individual. But if you ever go into a high school, they all look the same. There's groups of them, of course, but they all dress, you know, so their individuality is still the group norm. If you want to have, I would suggest take a picture of them when they're in 7th and 8th grade, how they're dressed, you know, when you really are concerned about the way they're dressed, and then show it to them through their adolescent years and then their young adult years on how they dress. See, look, see what you were wearing? You know, all black, you had these huge earrings on, and they'll go, oh, that's terrible, I never dressed that way. Take a picture, remind them of how they look. That will encourage them to dress a little differently, maybe.
Or better yet, look in your own photo albums.
Well, that's true, too.
Pointed out, as my children did.
Yeah, you can bring out, save all your clothes, because they will wear them. Stuff you wore in the 50s and 60s. I wish I had my saddle shoes back from those times, because saddle shoes are coming back again. I should have them bronzed or something, I don't know. Socially, the adolescent is in process, of course, of breaking ties with the family, searching for their own identity. Again, they are testing. They are moving from parental rules to one of mutually negotiated rules. They're moving from parent-child relationship as one of authority and unilateral respect to viewing it as a relationship more like friendship with peers, one involving equality and mutual respect. They are shifting from dependence to independence. And the way they do that, it's like a bridge. Dependence, independence, and the process of doing that is the peer group. Is the peer group. That's what gets them back and forth. But you will notice, and I want to restate this again, they will kind of leave. They will go out, and you'll test things out, and they'll come running back. And they'll go out, and they'll test things out, and they'll come running back. Because all of the stuff that they've taken in, they have to find out if it works. You know, okay, Mom and Dad, you've been telling me this. All right, now, this is being said. I'll go out, and they go out, do that, and they come back. And they go out, and they come back. And it's when they're coming back, if the parents or parent in the family or whatever is there for some type of support, it can be a lot easier for them. Part of the physical, and I forgot to mention one thing. Suggestions. Part of the physical and part of the social is the idea of trying to become a consultant with your kids. Emotionally and socially, do not embarrass them. They self-destruct with embarrassing. Do not use sarcasm, especially with the junior high age. They do not respond well at all to sarcasm. It kind of gets a little better when they get a little older, but please bite your tongue in talking with them. Never bawl them out in front of their friends. If they need a bawling out, pull them out of the room and gently tell them, you know, why you're angry at them or whatever, and then send them back in, but don't do it in front of their friends. Anybody else have any suggestions on those?
Have the coaches chew them out on fire too.
There you go. Oh, yes. Oh, I wish we could do that, yeah. My son plays Little League. Subject and a whole different 2-hour discussion, I'm sure, but it's too bad because I look at those type of sports, community sports, and what I see there are poor parenting skills being used in coaching.
Yeah, that's right.
And my feeling is not totally, because we have been lucky on some cases, some very, very concerned coaches that have really taken the time not only to coach, but they're also extension of parenting, and you can tell by how their family is, they carry that over to the coaching aspect. But at the same time, I've seen very dysfunctional coaches and dysfunctional coaching family. And I find that somebody should do a book sometime on the relationship of the coach's son or daughter with whoever, with the parent that's coaching. It's an interesting relationship that goes on in that.
I was a Boy Scout master, and one thing I always made sure I did is that when a boy worked on an individual type advancement and he had to answer questions, it was always in privately. I had seen in the past in the program before I got into it that here's a group of, you say, 15, 20 boys, similar age, and they're firing questions at one individual young man, and if he doesn't know the answer, he's very much embarrassed and you don't see him anymore. You're done.
Yeah, exactly. They embarrass very easily at a drop of a pin. Some other suggestions: help them to understand what's going on, either physically or socially or mentally. That help them to understand what is going on, first off, and then help them to understand what is going on is generally good. Is generally good, and that physical problems are not spiritual problems. Some adolescents will, concerning, let's say, feet or something like that, will blame God, or they'll say, because I'm praying for smaller feet and it's not happening, da 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 da. But they need to know there's not a connection between their physical development and their spiritual development. It's not a spiritual issue. Assist the slow developers to affirm themselves in other areas. I've already talked about letting them know that they look nice. Need to respect the fads, the friends, the confidences, the room privacy, music, and time to be alone. Respecting the music doesn't mean you have to put up with it going full blast either, okay? But they have a certain music, and we all had our certain music during years. We have to admit that, and our parents probably got after us about the music. But we need to respect their music. And the other aspect, too, I think, is that parents, or parent, if you're a single parent with teens, need to get away at times. One of the problems I see with some parents in adolescence is that they tend to either overparent and in the process do not take care of themselves. Parents need to get away. You either need to send the teen away to camp for a week, or you need to leave and have someone else stay with you, but you need to take care of yourself in this whole process of parenting teens. Okay, and then finally the spiritual. It's an exciting time, I think, basically for spiritual, but I have some concerns about it. It is a time of doubting and disbelief. Teenagers will generally, especially the early adolescents, will reject or have serious doubts about religion in general. And we should not see it as them as they are rejecting God or faith, but in fact they are rejecting authority. Keep in mind it's a time of questioning all of authority, and they see religion and the church as being part of that authority. So it doesn't necessarily mean that they're rejecting God. In fact, I've had some of the worst cases of kids in confirmation classes that have either ended up in the ministry or on their way to the ministry, or end up to be what, good kids or whatever. But it's interesting, they were tares in the confirmation class, and they questioned everything, they hated everything, da da da. And yet, in visiting with them through the years, they had, and I would ask them about prayer. Yes, they pray regularly. I asked them about Bible reading. Yeah, pretty much so. Ask them, other types of religious questions, and ask them about their spiritual development, and it was fine, and it was fine. So don't take it necessarily as a rejection of God or a rejection of the faith, but rather as a rejection of authority.
Excuse me?
Yes.
There's one thing I noticed with my son.
Can you speak a little louder?
Excuse me.
Yeah.
There's one thing I've noticed with my son, and I seem to remember when I was an adolescent, that you can't tie up feelings with spirituality. And if you're not feeling spiritual, then you wonder if it's really, if God's really there.
Yeah.
And he's asked questions. And he's felt guilty, enormous guilt, like, well, I don't feel like God's there, and so that must mean I don't believe. And what if He really is? And what do you think of me?
And that's a tough question. Has anybody else experienced that, either themselves or with kids or with working with kids?
I think he feels responsible for having spiritual feelings.
Yeah.
And he ties that up.
And how would you answer that? Anybody? How would you answer that?
Well, I just told him that feelings lie. You feel good sometimes, and you feel bad sometimes, but it isn't a measure of what's really happening.
Yeah, exactly. Need to separate out that spiritual aspect from the feeling aspect. It's there's an issue with adolescence in spirituality that concerning commitment and failure. There's a lot of peer group pressure and demand more than they are capable of giving. And I think somewhat of the church, and I've noticed this, let's say, with the junior high kids in confirmation classes and senior high with youth group, that commitment, there's a tie between commitment and failure, and there's a fear to be committed to anything because they fear they may fail at it. And that fear of failure is a big thing amongst the adolescents. I think it's big amongst the adults, but I think it's more so probably with the junior high and the senior high. So they're afraid to commit. They don't want to commit to the church necessarily full-heartedly. They don't want to commit to the faith full-heartedly because they don't know what it means to measure up in that. And that's just another thing that they may fail at, and they are quite fearful of that. Peer groups. How many of you have dealt with an adolescent who got ostracized from the peer group or lost their friends? Or maybe you can remember that yourself. Yeah, and how devastating that is. The feel of failure. I failed at my peer group. Yes?
A woman at our church said something to our son when he had wore one earring. She said something about, doesn't that mean you're gay or some dumb remark like that, and he won't go back to church?
No.
Can't convince him that it's just one dumb remark and everybody doesn't feel that way.
Maybe you ought to find some time when she's wearing earrings and have them ask the same question. I don't know. Ooh, that's bad. I'm sorry. The kids, though, religion and spirituality, it is a wonderful time to apply faith issues to the real world. It's if you're ever involved with a church that does service projects, I mean major service projects, the youth group at our church, our youth director, they have 3 work projects coming up this summer. They're going to Eastern Washington here to build houses for migrant workers. They're going to Tijuana to work in the inner city. And they're going, I can't remember where the third place was. Last year they went to Israel, both as an educational event, but also to work with Arab youth on building buildings and stuff like that. They're capable of doing that. They respond very well to seeing their faith in action, more so than they do in learning probably all about the Ten Commandments. They need to see that in action. It's a good time for adolescents to work with adolescents, to be involved, because faith can now become much more personal, and they have a strong desire to serve. They are extremely idealistic. On one morning, they want to probably solve the world hunger problem. They probably have ideas about it, and they want you to listen to all their ideas. And within the next half hour, or at least half day, they've completely forgotten about world hunger, and they're on to some other issue. So, and they're very idealistic. The importance at this time is in the area of models, I believe, parental models and other significant adults. But it's important that the parents and the other significant adults do not become adolescents or do not try to be adolescents. They need to be adults. I have a list of 20 needs of adolescents that were put together by a group of adolescents and adults. And the adolescents saying there all the time that they want adults to be genuine. They want adults to be adults. They don't want adults to be adolescents. I remember being on a bus, large bus, going to a convention, junior high. And you can pick out who the junior high youth workers were. You know, they were running up and down the aisles with all the kids. They were wearing the beanies. They were, you know, just having a wonderful time. And the kids don't need adults to be kids. They need adults to be adults. For the junior high age, I would recommend avoid pushing them into major decisions or commitments. My almost 12-year-old comes up every 2 weeks, sighs deeply and says, "You know, Dad, I don't know what I'm going to do in life." And I say, "Son, I'm 39, and I don't know what I'm going to do in life either." So. But they don't need to make those major decisions and commitments. And Eric Erickson, the psychologist, sociologist, or social psychologist, has a wonderful quote. He says that junior hires are never really ready to install lasting idols or ideals as guardians of a final identity, which raises for me the question of what we do in the confirmation years. And I really have a difficult time in asking kids to make this commitment when I know that for a junior hire to be committed means I'll be committed to a point where I don't want to be committed anymore. See what I mean? They aren't ready to make those lasting commitments. Now there's a movement among some parishes, I understand, in the North Dakota area, Lutheran parishes, where it's called, their confirmation is called longer and later. They start the process in the 5th grade. It's geared towards the parents' involvement, and there's stages of things that need to be done, and they get confirmed as a family when they're in junior or senior high and high school, which I would think would be a marvelous idea. Anyway, a suggestion to handle the spiritual and the religious: the kids need to hear your spiritual journey. They need to hear your questions on religion. They need to hear your beliefs. And they need to know why this is important to you, why your beliefs are important to you. They need to hear that. Don't assume that they're getting that. They need to hear it verbally from you. Any questions on that? We have a few minutes left. Let me read something to you, if that's okay. And maybe that'll generate some thought. First off, I didn't recognize if there were any questions or concerns. Any questions? Any comments? Yes.
Back to physical growth.
What do
teenagers feel? How do they think they look when acne starts developing?
Oh, they think it's devastating. They think it's God's curse.
I have a
boy. Well, how did you feel when acne? Did you have any
problems. Oh. My boy has fair skin, and he gets sort of a rash when he has citrus drink. This is
That's the orange juice. It's just allergic reaction. He says, Mom, why can't I have allergies or acne just like everyone else?
Mm-hmm.
And he gets all, but I'm wondering, do they think they're the ugliest person you've ever come around the world?
One zip can ruin a whole day, a whole lifetime in their estimation, a whole day as a parent because you're dealing with that. Oh yeah, they're very attuned. Their physical appearance is very important.
How can you reassure them through that? Every single day of doing that. And I don't know if she's listening or you just have to do it every day.
Every day. Mm-hmm. Just reassure them. Empathize with them as much as you can, I like to tell people to focus on their feeling, but be careful because don't overanalyze your youth either, and don't demand that they express their feelings. Well, how do you really feel about that? Okay. I don't want to talk about it. All right, give them, that's fine. Well, how do you really feel about it? No, you can, at times, what happens a lot is that they will come back at another time and they will tell you how they feel about it. If you can identify the feeling, that's called reflective listening for the parenting skills. That is helpful, but you can overuse techniques with adolescents and they will quit coming back if all they're going to hear is, well, you sound like you're angry. Because they're usually going to be happy, depressed, angry. I don't know if any. That's about the three covers them, good choices. I think too that if they are troubled, you need as a parent to ask them about it. And if you hear the phrase "never mind," then a little red flag should go up. Whether they came in and started talking, and you were on the phone or something, and then you turned to them and you said, "Now what?" And he said, "Oh, never mind." A red flag should go up because something's seriously bothering them. So, tuck that in the back of your mind. Whenever you hear the word "never mind," that's something you need to keep track of. Doesn't mean you track them down immediately if they go running off, but sometime else bring it around and talk to them about it. Yep.
We hear a lot of, they'll start a conversation with a woman on the phone or something opportune time, or else he'll just start a conversation and when you address him, and he'll say, "Oh, never mind."
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
This happens a lot. Is this just attention getting, or is he really thought better of speaking about it?
Several things. First off, it's quite normal. Mm-hmm. I've heard it said that many adolescents cannot complete a full sentence. Okay. Part of that has to do with their mental process. They'll come up with one thing that they want to talk to you about, and in the process of getting half of it out, it isn't important anymore, or they lose their thought, or they go on to something else. That's what they mean, that they can't complete a full sentence. Okay. It can be an attention getter, sure.
How hard should you pursue it? Sometimes you don't.
let me answer that with this. To me, there are two tasks in parenting, especially parenting teens. One, the first task is to raise emotionally stable children that can finally leave the home. And second is to preserve the sanity of the parents. Those are the two goals of parenting. Now, how much you should pursue depends on how much your sanity is involved, I think. I think we also have to come to a point in our lives as parents of teens that they do have capabilities of figuring out their own problems. And they need to develop that. They're developing it around you and us or whatever. But they do have that capability, and it does generally work out. The vast majority of teenagers do grow up to be wonderfully functioning adults. I've seen a few, and I've experienced that.
I think it's been difficult is that we as parents are not changing emotionally, spiritually, physically, all this that's happening to them, at least not in the same degree. And when they were in elementary, we had a relationship with them that worked quite well.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very much a part of our lives and very much involved. And then all of a sudden, it changes so drastically that it takes us a while to catch up. I'm on my third adolescent, so I'm starting to catch up with people that don't talk to you when you ask a question, and that I have to be available and be perceptive when they they want to talk. It usually is the inappropriate, I mean, that's the norm. Where when they were younger, you could sit down and you're going to have this talk.
And they might even listen to you when they're
angry. Right, you can have a dialogue, but now it's, you know, 11 o'clock at night and you're just ready to drop off and they come in and they kind of linger and all of a sudden it's now, and if you don't recognize it, you're not going to get it again. It's not when it's convenient for you, but it's like I had to learn that what worked all the way through elementary and younger, I have to learn a new style of parenting.
Yeah.
And that just was...
There is one question that you brought up that I don't know if you can see this back there, but... you know, when parents get to be the ages of 40, 45, actually 35 on up, 40, let's say, dad's 42, okay? And let's say a son can be, or a daughter, what would be a good age? If dad's 42, how old is one of the teenagers?
17.
17, it would fit in, right? 25 would be a time to have a child, right? Now, when a 17-year-old is going through all of this, let's add another 14-year-old. Let's add a 12-year-old. That way we get the whole spectrum. All right, dad is going through, we talk about emotionals, we talk about the physical, we talk about the spiritual, we talk about the mental, not so much mental. What was the other one? Social. Well, dad is starting to question and go through the whole aspect again. On the emotional side, dad, people going through midlife, especially males, tend to become more attuned to some of the emotions that they have left untapped over a period of time. Physically, they are looking in the mirror and finding out that they can't suck in the gut any longer, that it's a normal hanging out now, and that's the way it's going to be. They aren't, you know, the hair's falling out. See? Hair's falling out. Mine just slides down. They start asking the spiritual questions, you know, what is the meaning of life? Everybody goes through this, all right? The mental, I'm not quite sure on anything mental. I'm not anything on that. Socially, they're questioning their friends, their relationships with spouse, if they're still married or whatever. So all of this, what they're going through here, is the same thing that they're going through there. And when I do a class, I do a session on raising parents, and I try to point this out to the teens. You know, here they're going through all of this question about their physical appearance, and their parents are starting to go through the same thing. You know, mom figures, you know, finds out that she isn't as cute as the young 14-year-old. And there's actually become, you know, some jealousy involved in that too. You know? So that a lot of that, and this is where a lot of tension happens. This is where families end up having to go in and finding some professional help to help them get through this stage. Because all of this is going on, and this is heavy stuff for them, and it's very heavy stuff for the adults too. Yes?
As children grow older, I know lots of teens don't share with their mom and dad because maybe they're too close to the situation or whatever, but I think it's important to acknowledge that and say, you know, there may be issues that you don't want to share with your dad and I, but if you're really concerned, would you please, you know, seek out school counselor, Sunday school teacher, pastor, to give them some resources for other kinds of things, and for the parents not to take it so personally that the teen doesn't share everything with them. And I think just maybe it's because they're too close to the situation can't maybe give some perspective. And for what you just addressed, my son just turned 16. In the last 2 weeks, the mobility that he has gained because of a driver's license in his pocket is just, I mean, it's a whole new world. And so my answer to him lately, when I can't just give him a decision, yes or no off the top, or I'm unhappy with when he's pushing to, you know, take a longer drive than what I want him to, is to just, you know, give me some time to get used to his new mobility.
Yeah.
And to give me some space and you know, back and forth to town, let's that be okay for a few weeks. And then we'll try down to the dam to the movie.
Very good, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Just because I was raised very strictly, my husband had much more mobility, and it's almost causing problems between he and I, because, you know, I mean, it's a whole new world.
And if you share that with them,
even
though their response is, oh, so what, you know, so, it sticks in the back of their mind. It really does. They need to hear that stuff, whether you get the nice, respectful response, oh, yes, Mother, I understand very well now. You know, I doubt if you get that, but at least you've gotten it out. Yeah.
Another thing I've been doing with my son, because he started driving, he asked if he can go sit in some space. I said, that's fine. I says, He'll say, what time do you want me in? And I'll say, okay, what time do you want to be home? And so far, for example, the other night, he says, well, I can be home by about 9 or whatever. I said, that sounds like a reasonable time. I said, well, I should make it 10. I said,
careful, go back by
now. My idea is, and he said, 10? Really? And what I'm trying to portray to him that we can be flexible on this and let's work it out instead of me saying, okay, 8:30, that's it. And he's going to say, well, gee, I want it 9, Dad. And the whole conversation is closed. But if I can give him some flexibility, and when the time comes, he says, I want to be out at midnight, I say, hey, no, 11 o'clock, we can talk about it. Because he's had a chance to have this flexibility.
Flexibility in rule and guidelines are a must. You have to be flexible. You know, you can't lay down the law and expect the 14-year-old to follow it all the way, because there's going to be exceptions. And then when a 14-year-old becomes 16 or 17, the rule's outdated. It really is. And it almost has to be flexible within a week's time, almost. Okay. I would recommend, I don't know if people have attempted this or are using it now, but we do family meetings. And I know of some families where it's been very successful. And a family meeting for us, we use a general family meeting if an issue comes up, but we also use a family meeting on a monthly basis, and some other families do it on a weekly basis, which is hard to do with teenagers because they're not home half the meals anyway. But there needs to be a time where they can get together, where they can discuss family issues, where they can discuss what the rules and the boundaries are, what the chores are, they can exchange chores, they can plan out vacations or whatever, or if there's some issue between two of them or between them and a parent, that can be discussed. We usually have a family meeting with the younger kids. If you start it with younger kids way young, they usually last less than about 4 minutes because of attention span. But our kids now are calling for the family meetings on their own. They say, when is our next family meeting? And it's a fun time, and we share some stuff. We try to do a process, such as go around and say something positive about everybody around there. We conclude it with some food. You always, as Lutherans, we always have to eat whenever we meet. But we also, a tradition that we have started is a family hug at the end. Mom and Dad get down on their knees, so we're down on, which is fastly disappearing because the two oldest are getting much taller, but we have a family hug. Okay. That has been a good positive aspect, and I would recommend that with parents to attempt to do that.
That was my point. If that works in for a point,
yeah.
And then when they become adolescents, you can do the same concept, but you have to rename and reform.
Yeah. But what works with the adolescent is when I want to have one, all you have to say is fine. We'll talk about you. And a lot of adolescents do not like the fact that they're not going to be present when something's going to be talked about.
You know. We start a game night, and TV's off, the stereo's off. We just go to, and each person whose night it is picks out what game they want, Monopoly or whatever else, and we have a game night. That's worked out pretty good.
We tried that, and it worked for a while until our youngest came up and. Playing musical chairs for about an hour with a 3-year-old doesn't.
Yeah, it only works with certain.
Yeah, that's right. It does.
You know, if you have a large band, it's not as effective.
But vary it too. You know, have a game night, whatever it needs to do. But you need to program that stuff in, and if you do it early enough, they'll get used to it in the teen years, and it becomes a benefit to them because you know issues are done, and especially if what they have to say is listened to. And respected, no matter how crazy it can be sometimes. Yeah.
What is your feeling spiritually? Like, how much do you push on? I mean, I'm having trouble. My kids don't want to go to church anymore, and we do tell them they have to go most of the time because we don't go all the time either. Mm-hmm. So,
bingo, there's your answer. No.
But I mean, you know, I don't know how much. And they go in spurts. Sometimes they're going real heavily for a certain program, or they're involved in something, some extra things at the church, and then we lay way off a little while. But I don't.
How old are they?
13 and 15, and it's really hard. Even the services at night, they're different. You know, than where you or anyone will be, and they're kind of sitting there. At this point, we've gone to two, making fun of them, and I make them be quiet, and then later we talk a little bit about it, but. they're almost in a mocking stage right now, and I don't know if this is going to go on all week. Like, this is dumb, they shouldn't do it this way, you know.
That will go on for a while. I mean, that's quite normal.
I don't know. Do you still make them go to these things? I mean, absolute rule that go to
I would. Everything. Yeah, I would.
So, and if they're not resentment, more resentment caused? Or, I don't know.
A point will come to where, as long as you emotionally can handle them, they are, you know, the process, I would keep them going as often as. And then the choice will come. But I think the choice has to be theirs. But what they need to see is the fact is this important for mom and dad? And there's going to be a point where they're not going to think it's important at all, but I think they're also going to come back to it.
Mm-hmm.
I think I see now a lot of young families and a lot of young individuals attempting to return to the church on a regular basis. There's a big article in the Seattle Times about it. And I think the people are coming back because of the fact that we live in a high-tech society and they're looking for high touch. And the church is the only institution, I think, right now that can give that high touch to the whole family system. And I think they're looking for that. And I think the church has an opportune time, but I don't think the church is ready. I think we're still dragging our feet. And if they don't, I'm afraid to see or say what might happen within 10 years if the church doesn't take the initiative now, because they're going to lose them again and they probably won't come back for a long, long time.
What initiatives are we talking about?
Can we save that? There's about 5 minutes. I'll be happy to talk to you under the bell or whatever sometime. Any other questions? We've got a few minutes left. Yes?
Jobs at home. Chores. We've got a lot of homework coming home, but you feel that there needs to be regular chores happening, regular responsibility to the family. How do you juggle that? Any magic words?
Magic words. Chores. Juggling chores between times, between like their homework and stuff.
And
right?
They gotta have fun time too. Right?
Yep.
They gotta daydream, like you said, they gotta play. But do you think it's important that they have regular responsibilities other than just making the bed or personal?
Oh, definitely. They have to, I think, give something to the family unit. And part of the family is that these things have to be done. And we as a family, or you as an individual, will not have such and such time until this gets done. Our almost 6-year-old's number one chore is taking his nightlight out. That was, getting him to do that was a wonderful, but that's how he contributes to the family. For teenagers, yes, definitely. There has to be. How you do it and how much they do, that varies from unit to unit, I think.
Okay, and then this is related right to it. Is it a bad thing or a good thing? Sometimes you work around the house as punishment. I don't know if I'm saying it right, but we have a lot of manure to be picked up in the pasture.
Do they dislike picking up manure in the pasture?
It's not their favorite thing, and they do it occasionally, kind of regularly, occasionally when it needs to be done. But when we're having, you know, a terrible time with behavior or fighting, that you don't say, okay, there's a lot of manure out there. Is that in the rural case or in general?
No, right. I don't think so. I think what you have to be careful about in the area of punishment is that it doesn't become more of a problem for the parent, and that it doesn't, you know, like grounding somebody for